Welcome to Between the Rows, where you get to hear the stories behind the stories in Canada's leading farm publications.
Hello and welcome to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Dave Bedard. It's no secret that Ontario's provincial government since last summer has been looking for ways to cut costs and find operating efficiencies. Its publicly stated plan to do so involves looking at its practices with the same sort of analysis used by companies such as Toyota to help improve productivity and profitability. That seems to work well for a company that's making Tundra pickups and RAV4s, and we'll see, I guess, whether that works for a provincial service delivery system. But the provincial Ag and Food Ministry is now wondering whether lean principles can be put to work on Ontario farms as well to help improve the farmer's bottom line. John Greek is the editor of our Ontario Farm Journal, Farmtario, and he's on the phone with us now. John, welcome back to Between the Rows.
Thanks, Dave.
So how did the Ag Ministry make the jump from lean analysis of its own operations to applying the same principles to farms?
I think some of the people involved in the process within the ministry were looking at what they were being pushed to do, you know, in their own operations, and said, well, maybe this is something we can also apply to what we do to farms, and there might be some value added that they could do to farms. I know it's being driven by a couple of people with that interest, and then there's also an engineer that was hired in the last while who doesn't come from agriculture, comes from the systems process side, who brings some expertise in lean management and efficiency to the ministry.
Well, lean management seems to work for a company that makes over 10 million vehicles a year. I mean, at that scale, it's easy to see where even the smallest adjustments in processes could make a significant difference. But on the average Canadian family farm, though, isn't that just micromanaging?
That's a fair point. And I asked on Twitter if there were farmers who were making deliberate use of these sorts of systems. And one comment was, well, yes, it's called common sense, and we do that in continuous improvement all the time. So certainly that's a bit well taken. But I think the point of lean management, it goes by several, you know, there are several different iterations of it, Six Sigma or Kaizen or lean, is to step back and take a deliberate look at what you do. And on farms, we've done the things we've done for a long time often, and even, you know, our own lives off the farm or even not running farms, or the things we do that we just do because we've always done in that process, that we just work around all the time just because that's what we've done for a long time. And if you really look at what the lean process says, it's more than just waste. It's also what's the optimum value in the system, or the optimum value of what you're doing. So taking a step back and looking at those things, I don't think hurts in any process, really, especially one that, you know, that's a decent sized business. Even the size of a farm is a decent sized business these days, of course. And then having an extra set of eyes, you know, farmers are the experts in their business and they know them intimately, you know, very well. But that's also goes back to they've also been doing it for a while, and it never hurts to have an outside view of things, especially if you're running a process that involves multiple pieces of equipment or a significant amount of labor. That's where you probably will find your biggest efficiencies.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your feature in the latest issue of Farmtario, the province has already applied lean principles on some farms in your part of the country. What can you tell us about those?
There are a couple of examples they use. So one is a carrot farm, and also had a carrot packing facility on the farm, and they were finding that they were getting had too much dirt-filled water that they were having to dump at the end of their process. And so they went back and looked at it with the help of some of MAFRA engineers, and they took two or three steps that solved the problem. So first of all, they were bringing in quite a bit of dirt with their carrots into the packing facility. So they installed a shaker on the harvester, which knocked some of the dirt and left it in the field where it should be. They were also putting all of the carrots that came in there through the washing process, and then they were grading them. So now they grade before they put them into the washing process, and that's also taken a significant amount of the carrots out of the washing process and therefore reduced the dirt load and the water load on the other end. And then there were some simple plate changes by a matter of degrees that ended up better balancing the process in reducing the amount of water used. Another example that one of them told me is very simple. A farmer was in his shop watching some people working on his combine, and they'd use a tool under the combine, crawl out on the front of the combine, go across the shop, get the next tool, come back, crawl into the combine, do the work, get out, go across the shop to get the next tool. Now the toolboxes on that farm are now on wheels, so they go to the combine. And you know, that's kind of an example a lot of people use. There's a book called The Lean Farm, which is written by an American farmer who runs a small market garden business, but employs two people full time, and they quite ruthlessly attacked inefficiencies in that small business, and that was both inefficiencies from the standpoint of the crops they grew, and as well break down to tool placement and that sort of thing. So it's kind of simple things like that. And then they tell me they're working with a maple syrup producer who now sells a lot of his syrup wholesale, who wants to process more, and they think they can find a lot of things if they apply this type of lens to it before he creates his assembly line process for the maple syrup.
Now, it's interesting too that OMAFRA's Environmental Services branch is the one that's spearheading this. You know, maybe I'm just being cynical, but I wouldn't expect to hear the words efficiency and environment in the same breath.
So this is part of some of the things I've been writing about recently, is that agriculture actually has a good environmental impact story to tell in its efficiency improvement, and the people in the Environmental Services branch seem to understand this, that most of the time when you improve an efficiency of a farm process, you also have an improved environmental impact, whether that's less fertilizer use, less pesticide use, less water use, fewer trips over the field. All of those things actually have an environmental impact as well as an on-farm economic impact.
Mm-hmm. And I gather that when it comes to reducing waste through lean management or lean systems, we're not just talking about the waste of tangible assets such as fuel or crop inputs or what have you.
No, there's also everything from energy to water, of course, and then the use of people. The labor is an issue on farms all across the country, and the idea that that's not going to get any better might lend itself to an evaluation of a farm based on these principles, or a process on the farm based on these principles. If it helps improve labor efficiency, then that would be in the day when it's hard to find people, that could be a help as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, where that would also come in handy too is when it comes time for farmers and processors even to sort of place a higher value on their own time. I mean, there's a lot of farmers that both you and I know who place the value on their own time at zero.
That's right. Yeah, that's definitely true too. And yeah, when you do something and you like doing it, it's not necessarily as efficient as it could be.
Mm-hmm. Now, do we know yet whether the results that they've seen in their case studies are enough for OMAFRA to keep this project going in the longer term?
I don't think they've figured that out yet. I think this is really just a project of a few people who have seen that this is something that could be helpful. And it's really, it's a staff-initiated project. It's not a larger policy necessarily, or funding that's driving this. I don't think we know yet, but they're quite enthusiastic about it at this point.
And something we'll certainly be watching to find out. John Grieg, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, Dave. Take care.
John Grieg is the editor of Farmtario. You're listening to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Dave Bedard. Along with the big milestone in Canadian agriculture this week, the beginning and the end of the longest rail strike in the past decade, we saw another milestone reached here in Winnipeg, where in 1969, the members of the Saskatchewan, Ontario, BC, and Alberta Farmers Unions held their founding convention as the National Farmers Union. Coming full circle, the group's 50th anniversary convention was held this week here in Winnipeg. Katie Ward is a ninth-generation mixed farmer northwest of Ottawa. She's the current president of the NFU and kindly took time out of her meetings this week to chat with us. Here, have a listen.
So I just turned 50 myself, and it was all I could do to say to my family, I don't want a big birthday party. I don't even want to think about it. You know, let's just have a nice dinner and, some cake, and then I'll just flake out on the couch as usual. Mm-hmm. You know, with that in mind, congratulations on this organization, reaching this its first half century. Mm-hmm. And now that you're all here in Winnipeg where it started, and from your perspective as president, how's the NFU feeling about being 50?
I think we may be the most energized 50 I've ever seen. this has been a really interesting learning experience in the planning of just all of the... I just turned 40 myself, so I wasn't around when the NFU was founded, but there's so much history in this organization and so many incredible fights that have been engaged in to stand up for fairness for farmers. And so we've spent a lot of time yesterday in intergenerational knowledge transfer and seeing how many young farmers we have here celebrating this and are engaged and excited about connecting with people who were here at the founding of the National Farmers Union and the decision to stand together from the provincial farm unions. It's been really, really exciting, and now we're starting to take stock of, okay, what are we now facing today in agriculture, and then we are starting to look forward to the next 50 years, and farming in the next 50 years is going to be very, very different than it was, and we need to make sure that we are planning for and going to be just as excited to get together and celebrate our wins and stand beside each other over the next 50 years. So, yeah, this has been a great couple of days already.
So no signs of a midlife crisis then? Nobody's buying a convertible or or a Harley Davidson
right
or
the sunset? Yeah. No, not at all. There is a real sense of joy actually among our members. It is a celebration for us here this week. We always have to deal with current events and issues, but we are celebrating. It's an important milestone for us, and not just seeing old friends, but there are some folks who have come to help celebrate that haven't been able to attend in a couple of years because of age or health reasons or what have you, that are here. So we're taking these opportunities to reconnect with old friends we haven't seen in a while and some of our inspirations. I mean, there are giants of farming vision and policy in the NFU, and really great to be able to personally connect with them.
I've seen a few of them on the guest list as well. Just looking at the website and whatnot. It's quite a roster you've got this year.
We do, absolutely. Nettie Weeb, who is one of our past presidents, who was the first female president of a farm organization in Canada, is actually on stage speaking right now about. You'll be able to listen to her, hopefully.
I'm just, my apologies for taking you away from...
she's a wonderful, wonderful inspiration, and she was instrumental in the NFU in Canada being a founding member of La Via Campesina, which is the international small farmers movement, millions of small farmers over the world, and making sure that we understand we're all facing a lot of common struggles, no matter where we are. We have differences, but... we have a lot in common. Just like a prairie grain farmer might not feel like sometimes they have a lot in common with a market gardener in Eastern Ontario or someone growing strawberries in New Brunswick or a dairy, farmer in British Columbia. But you know what? We do all have an awful lot in common, and this is where we get to celebrate that. So.
Now, I was looking at the NFU statement of purpose from 1969, and focusing as it does on the idea of shared goals of community, on what unites Canadian family farmers, mm-hmm. Rather than sort of the pursuit of narrow self-interest and whatnot. Mm-hmm. What's it like for the NFU specifically to maintain itself and to sort of promote this notion of farmers working in a common cause at a time when, it seems statistically anyway that there are fewer and fewer farmers each year?
There are fewer of us. I mean, it's a fact that we have to face, but at the same time, that means that we really need to recognize that we can't just stand as individuals. When there's just one or two people who are speaking up on an issue, it's really easy for you to be ignored. But if you band together and, you know, stand up as a group, there is strength in numbers, and we are stronger when we stand together. And I think, you know, even across the various farm organizations, when we find common ground, even though we disagree on a lot of things, we can get our point across better. And, you know, it's good to have allies, and whether it's within your own organization or outside. And I think that's something we've always been strong, you know, had as a strength in the NFU, is that concept of finding your allies and making common cause, and you can get things done that way.
Mm-hmm. Although granted, I mean, as with any membership based organization, I mean, how healthy is the organization itself right now?
We actually came out of a bit of a rebuilding period in the last couple of years, and we've hired a new executive director who is with us today, and she's going to be starting officially in the new year. Well, she's here with us all week, actually, and is getting quite an introduction to the National Farmers Union and our democratic debates and processes. And she's really keen to help us expand our membership base and, you know, talk to farmers about what their concerns are and how we can help meet them, because there's always room for growth.
But not only are there fewer farmers, but it also seems lately anyway that, you know, certainly in the last few years, that the whole arena of public policy seems much more focused, much more divisive than ever, you know, that there's a lot of people selling the idea of us versus them, you know, and into that comes this group with the idea of a union of farmers, you know, at the same time, you know, viewing itself as, you know, sort of being on the front
and
line
isn't
of a,
that a refreshing change, right? I mean, you don't hear a lot of, well, maybe we should try to find common ground as a discussion point in the you know, general societal debate these days, and so we can be a refreshing, relaxing option that isn't just always pushing people to be angry and blame someone else for your problems. And maybe we need to have more respectful debate and try to find community again, which is really, especially with, you know, we have our Facebook bubbles and, you know, this us versus them and the rural-urban divide. And we've actually got some really interesting speakers on our agenda today speaking about that, because it's a concern. We really do worry about that. And how do you get that message across when people are very siloed? You know, to use an appropriate agricultural metaphor. And it's something we're very concerned about in the National Farmers Union, but also I think everybody should be concerned about. You know, there's lots of discussion about it in the media as well, how polarized debates have become. And I think especially because we are geographically relatively isolated on our farms, you know, it can feel very lonely. And so we need to, in order to make agriculture relevant to policy discussions, because we are such a small population of the small proportion of the population, we need to be able to have conversations with more of the majority of voters, who are the ones who are pushing policy. And we need to create understanding about the situations that we're facing on our farms. And it's not just, you know, farms are not doing the right thing by the environment. And, you know, there's a lot of polarization even among the climate change discussion, and particularly, actually. And we want to be able to open that conversation about how we can do good things on our farms in the climate crisis context, and that we can be part of the conversation and we can be part of the solution to the problem, as opposed to just always saying, nope, I'm going to handle things on my own farm. You know, we need to have a plan.
And it's interesting too. I mean, just the getting back to the concept of a union, but also at the same time, you know, there was the book launch here this week, talking about the idea of farmers on the front line and sort of this battle against external forces and whatnot. And as you said too, I mean, not every farmer necessarily sees those forces as a threat either.
True. That is true. At the same time, we have an opportunity to, and I think we've generally been pretty good over the years about taking that opportunity to educate about what our position is, whether it be, historical issues like the crow rate, wealth extraction from the family farm, from the prairie farm particularly, and the hollowing out of rural communities that's resulted. Just because people don't agree with us on certain issues doesn't mean we can't necessarily find common ground with them on other issues. Or, sometimes you agree to disagree on something, but we, use our democratic process in our convention to really thoroughly analyze our policy positions, and we feel that we stand on solid ground when we take our policy stances, and we're happy to let folks know and give them some background that maybe they're not getting in other analysis somewhere else, and hopefully they can see the wisdom in the positions that we take.
And now this year at this convention, it was sort of pitched to members as, in part as passing on the lessons that members have learned along the way. Among those lessons, what would you sort of say are the most relevant now for people just coming into the organization at this point in 2019?
First one that comes to mind, especially in light of some of the historical struggles that we've engaged in that were discussed yesterday, in a really interesting intergenerational discussion with the youth, young farmers asking questions of our past leadership, and saying, "Tell me your stories." That the biggest thing I took away from that personally was, even if something is presented to you as, "This is what we are going to do. This is what policy the government is going to adopt," or whatever the situation might be, just because something is presented to you as, fait accompli, we're going to go ahead with this, you can talk to your friends, talk to your neighbors, you can make common cause with people. And if something is going to be problematic for you and your farm, you can stand up for yourself. And there are other people who will stand with you. And, we're all facing a lot of stresses on our farms. I'm relatively young myself, and I think, but, some of the newer farmers starting out are facing a really tough road ahead of them with the financialization of farmland and, just land access and the weather challenges that they're facing. Market access, there's a whole slew of problems that they're facing, but a lot of times when you're just coming into agriculture right out of school or as a second career, you don't necessarily know that there's a lot of people out there who are facing the same struggles. A lot of people tend to think, "I'm just going to have to work a little bit harder. It's, maybe it's me. Maybe I should be doing something differently and that would make it easier." But you know what? Sometimes everybody's facing the same problems. That means that there is an option for making structural change to help make your life and your farm work better. And if we work together and we institute policy that's going to help support farmers, then everybody's lives are going to be improved.
Mm-hmm. And on that note, I'd be remiss if I didn't talk about the big issue right now, of course, and the one that seems to have just been resolved this morning as we speak, the CN strike. I could spend all day, reading emails and statements from organizations wanting somebody to step in and end it right this minute, often through back to work legislation. I get that same sense of urgency from the National Farmers Union statements, but at the same time, asking people to consider, the matter from the union's perspective.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we were very pleased to see such a, you know, success come from the collective bargaining process. It wasn't immediate, but it was relatively quick, and you know, things can get rolling again. We felt it very important to point out that, you know, there is two sides to every story, and that, you know, workers deserve safe working conditions, and you know, we are always cognizant of the fact that there's risk of farm accidents on our farm, and we have to be careful. I wouldn't wish hazards on somebody else either. And so, you know, that needed to be taken into account in the bargaining process. And we have rights in a democracy, and collective bargaining is part of the system for a reason, and it was allowed to go forward, and I was very pleased to see that it worked.
Mm-hmm. Well, I better let you get back to Nettie Weeb and to the rest of your convention. Best of luck with the convention, and best of luck with the next 50 years as well.
Thank you very much. We're looking forward to it.
Katie Ward is the president of the National Farmers Union. You're listening to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Dave Bedard. It's a tough time to be in the seed breeding business if you're developing products best suited to the Canadian prairie market. If you're an organization or a company creating new varieties of value to farmers, you need to receive a bit more than just goodwill and happy thoughts to keep the lights on in the office. There's discussion underway about setting up a new royalty system to that end, but it looks like that discussion is a bit too late for the Canadian arm of Syngenta. Alan Dawson is a reporter with the Manitoba Cooperator. He's been following this issue, and he joins us now. Alan, welcome back to Between the Rows.
Thanks a lot, Dave.
So here we have Syngenta, a company that's long been involved in breeding new wheats and barleys worldwide, calls itself the world's largest wheat breeder. But what's the status now of its wheat breeding business in Canada?
Well, it recently announced that come the end of the year that they're going to be dropping their wheat breeding program in Canada.
Mm-hmm. So what does that mean for at least the people who are working with the program here? I mean, they're technically out of a job, I'm assuming.
That's the way it appears in the news release. They've talked about how they met with their staff, and it was bad news. But it doesn't look like that the program's going to continue. They announced that it's going to end at the end of the year. So, yeah, their wheat program in Canada is coming to an end.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, they've got wheat breeders at work here in Manitoba. They've been producing wheats for the prairies, and they say they have more coming down their R&D pipeline. Why aren't they sticking around?
Well, the way that they explained it to me, Nancy Tout, who's the head of R&D for Syngenta Canada, said that they want to focus their investments in other areas that they feel will bring more value to Canadian farmers and probably more value to Syngenta as well. And it's about refocusing their efforts. Nancy said that it has nothing to do, it's independent, she said, of the whole royalty discussion that's going on right now around mm-hmm. seeds. So she's saying there's, you know, it's not directly connected to that, but some people in the industry think it might be.
Mm-hmm. Where are we right now with the development of a royalty system for seed breeders working in Canada?
Well, I guess you'd say it's on hold, but likely to be resume soon. That we're getting into the winter meeting season, so prior to the election. Well, I guess even going further back, spring seeding, farmers are busy. Then we had the election period, so after last winter, it kind of dropped off, and there was a bit of a, I don't know if you'd call it a stalemate, but there was certainly a lot of pushback from farmers, concern raised about these two models that have been proposed, and and even some discussion about looking at alternative models. So the general farm organizations such as CAP in Manitoba, APAS, Saskatchewan, and the Alberta group put out a survey of farmers and generally found that the farmers didn't support, a majority of farmers did not support those two models that are being discussed.
Now, in your feature, you talked to some folks who are connecting the dots, of course, between these royalty discussions and Syngenta's plans for departure. What are seed companies saying about the process, especially now that a major player such as Syngenta is closing up shop?
Well, Cantera Seeds, which is a prairie-based seed company, works with seed growers and also has an agreement with Lima Grain on wheat breeding in Canada. Dave Hansen, who's the president and CEO of Cantera, said it really sends a bad signal to other companies, including his in this joint venture with Lima Grain, on where things are going. If Syngenta is worried about, not getting a return on investment, and they didn't say that in so many words, but the industry, again, is interpreting it that way, and so he feels it's a bad sign.
Now, what are the stakes here for wheat growers on the prairies if a new royalty system can't be developed sooner rather than later?
Well, it depends a lot on who you talk to. Amongst those who support some sort of change or reform in royalties, something that would result in plant breeders, both public and private, getting more return on their investment, they say that if we don't do something along those lines, it's going to be bad. That we've got good varieties now, but in the future there may not be, because they're arguing that there won't be the incentive, the monetary reward, to invest in plant breeding. But some farm groups and presumably a majority of farmers, based on those surveys, that survey, feel that there might be a different way to approach this. I think there's a consensus around farmers perhaps investing more in plant breeding, but they want some say or control over it. So there's a bit of a view out there amongst some farm groups and farmers that they're reluctant to sign a blank check, and what they feel might be a blank check in terms of just automatically money flowing to companies and the public sector. So it depends who you talk to. Some real concern about the long-term competitiveness of farmers if we don't have good new varieties, but then farmers being concerned about how much it might cost them, and having no guarantee that if they pay more that they'll necessarily get better varieties. Mm-hmm.
So, looking at as far as the competitiveness of farmers and new varieties, what about Syngenta's work to date? I mean, has their work so far been of help to prairie farmers?
Yeah, a few years ago now, they had 5602, which was one of the first varieties of wheat that had a MR, or moderately resistant rating to Fusarium head blight, and 5700 was number one CPS wheat in the prairies for a while there. So they've had some popular wheats in the past. Right now, I don't think they have too much maybe on the market that's, it's really right now CWRS class is being dominated by AAC Brandon and some other Ag Canada varieties. But in the past, Syngenta has had some popular varieties.
And they did say they had more to come in the pipeline also. I mean, it's, so even though they're packing up their wheat operations or their cereal operations here, there may still be more to come?
Well, that's right. They've got stuff in the pipeline, and I think there was a variety that was recommended for registration at last year's meetings. And yes, it's possible for them to bring in varieties that they've developed elsewhere that they think might have a fit here, although Nancy Tout she kind of downplayed that a little bit. But I think if they do have a winner perhaps or a new variety from developed in other parts of the world that they think might have a fit here, perhaps it might come to Canada. Although, again, to repeat myself, when I talked to her about that, she indicated that was not sort of a major focus of theirs, but I don't suppose they, she didn't necessarily rule it out 100% either.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess we'll have to wait and see. Alan Dawson, Manitoba Cooperator, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks a lot, Dave.
Alan Dawson's a reporter with the Manitoba Cooperator at Miami, Manitoba. We're talking to him today at the National Farmers Union Convention here in Winnipeg. You're listening to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Dave Bedard.
Canadian canola has seemed to be flying in a bit of a holding pattern these days, with market factors both lifting and dragging the commodity. Glenn Halleck is here from Glacier Markets Farm to elaborate. Glenn, welcome back to Between the Rows. Well, first off, let's look at ICE futures in canola. Doesn't seem to have really broken out one way or the other lately.
They've been range-bound. Last week it was Malaysian palm oil. Production is down in Malaysia and in Indonesia. That in turn is driving up soy oil at the Chicago Board of Trade, which in turn drives up canola prices up or down. And, you know, more recently, canola is going down because there's that lack of a trade deal between the U.S. and China. There's a lot of talk from, you know, U.S. President Donald Trump, from the Chinese government. But, you know, until there's concrete action, the markets just aren't buying anything yet. And we've seen the soy complex in Chicago go down, and that's dragged down canola by maybe $5-6 in the last couple of days.
But there seem to have been several factors supporting canola values also, which I guess is why, which I guess is what's keeping it range bound, isn't it?
Yeah, the dollar has dropped about a full cent or a little bit more. Once it gets past that 75-cent mark, then I think you'll even see canola prices pick up even more. That 75-cent mark seems to be some sort of psychological barrier, and right now we're just a little bit above that.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the CN strike as of this morning is now tentatively over, but did it go on long enough to help or hurt commodity prices depending on the market?
I think it all depends who you talk to. A lot in the trade will say that, you know, the lack of shipments by CN has hurt canola. That may be one reason why canola has pulled back a little bit. And now there's talk it could take several weeks to get that backlog of trains going again.
Mm-hmm. And now, looking beyond the export market, how profitable is the domestic crush market right now?
Oh, the crush has been doing very well for at least the last month. You know, margins, they had crept up to past $100 per ton. They've pulled back a little bit, but they're still in the high 90s, which is really good right now.
And one more market fundamental, of course, to look at, the prairie harvest. Is it as done as it's going to get?
Yeah, pretty much. The three prairie provinces, they've done their last crop reports for the fall. Overall, across the prairies, you know, about 90% of the canola was harvested. You know, Alberta was a little bit lower at 85%. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's still a lot of canola out there.
Mm-hmm. And I guess we'll be waiting, I guess, until spring to see how much more remains. Glenn, sorry.
Yeah. It all depends on how the crop weathers during the winter.
Mm-hmm. Glenn Halleck, thank you very much for your time, sir.
Oh, thanks, Dave.
Glenn Halleck writes for Markets Farm here in Winnipeg. That's all we have for this episode, but we'll be back in a week with more from the Glacier Farm Media family of publications. I'd like to thank our guests this week: Katie Ward, Alan Dawson, John Grigg, and Glenn Halleck. You've been listening to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Dave Bedard. Thanks for tuning in.
Between the Rows is a production of Glacier Farm Media, Canada's leading farm publisher. We'd love to hear what you think of the show and invite you to send your comments to etr@farmmedia.com or visit us at membersgetmore.ca and sign up today.